for me to imagine him rolling his eyes to himself. "You can do that anywhere, Kay. Listen, Ma and the aunts are flying out there Labor Day weekend. They want to stay at the house anyway, so why don't you let them help you pack? If you want, I'll even fly out with them and drive back with you. Jeannie won't mind. How's that sound? You and me driving coast to coast together? By the time we get back to Mass, you'll be ready to start out with a brand new sheet." He was about to say more, but then I heard Rudy grunt from a few feet away that Frank was going to blow a sail if he didn't get back out on the floor. "Kath, I gotta go. Think about it. I'll call you later." I wasn't even mad anymore. I didn't feel anything, really. Just dried up and hollow, like I'd run out of something important. "Frank? Yeah?" I was past telling him about the house, past asking for any real help from him. But I could ask him this. "You can't call me. I'm going on a trip. I planned it a long time ago, and I'm having some friends watch the house while I'm gone. Could you tell Ma that? Apologize for me. Tell her if I'd known earlier I... Okay, Kath. Anything to help. Look, I gotta go. Chin up, hon. Call me." I held on to the receiver until the dial tone came and listened to it a while before I hung up. That old dark feeling started to open up inside me, like I was in the basement of a house I couldn't escape. I knew my brother would tell Jeannie about me and Nick, that she would tell my mother, and then everyone would know the truth, that Kathy Nicola hasn't changed. 2 steps forward and 4 steps back. And I knew as soon as I heard my brother's voice, I couldn't tell him about Dad's house anyway. Not Frank. Always looking out for himself first, keeping his clothes clean and his hair parted straight. Only at his best when your problems don't have anything to do with him at all. When he can sit back in his expensive clothes at the lunch he's buying you and give cool, practical advice. Show how much he believes in you by giving you and your new husband a brand new Bonneville to drive west. As I walked around to my car door, the purple Malibu was backing away from the curb. One of the Chicano boys leaned his face out the window, looked at my crotch, and slowly licked his upper lip. I acted like I didn't see him, but when I got inside the Bonneville, I locked the door, started the engine, and waited for them to drive on to San Pablo. Then I lit a cigarette and drove south. The day had gotten brighter but cooler, and I could smell rusted freighter. On the East Shore Freeway, I passed the huge parking lot of the Golden Gate Fields racetrack, and there was the long span of Oakland Bay Bridge a few miles ahead, the hazy green of Yerba Buena Island at its halfway point, a gray ship there, a place Nick and I had pointed out to each other on maps when we first got here. I thought about driving south to Millbrae, just cruise around the housing complex near the mall till I found Lester's car parked in front of his family's house. But then what? Sit there and wait for his kids to come home from school? Watch Les and his wife step outside to greet them? I remembered what the colonel had said about Les, that his superior officers know everything. I wondered if I should try and contact him, warn him, but I didn't know how I could do that without somehow making things worse, having his wife answer the phone or the door if I ever found his house in the first place. I had the slow blood sick feeling you get with a hangover that plans to last all day. That and hunger pains, my stomach all tight with everything. I drove to the Mission District, parked on a street lined with palm trees, and walked 2 blocks in the sunshine past adobe apartment buildings to the Cafe Amaro and Connie Walsh's office above. Gary stood behind his desk on the phone. He was wearing a black and white Les Miserables t-shirt tucked into his jeans, his belly hanging slightly over his braided belt. The conference room door was open, and there was no one else in the waiting area. I had a feeling Connie Walsh wasn't in either. Her receptionist hung up and put his hands on his hips. "Well, look who the kitty dragged in." I didn't know if I wanted to kick a hole in the wall or curl up in a ball in my chair. I asked if Connie was here, and he said no, she wasn't, she's at court. "But she's tried to get a hold of you at your motel. She needs to know if she should begin proceedings against the county for you." "Oh my God, what happened to your arms?" I lifted my elbow and looked at my right upper arm, then at my left. They were already darkening to a light shade of purple. I looked back up at Gary. at his warm green eyes, the real caring in his face. "Look, I'm not at a motel. I can't afford a motel. And I don't want to sue the county, all right? I just want my fucking house back." I moved to his desk, took a pencil from a coffee mug, and started writing my P.O. box number on one of the pink memo pads next to his phone. If Connie can come up with something new, she can write to me. Otherwise, there's nothing else to talk about. I walked back down the dark stairwell to the cafe, and I should have felt guilty about talking like that to my lawyer's secretary, but it had felt good to let go at someone, anyone. I stood in the cafe, not knowing if I wanted to eat something or not, but on the sound system was that meditative New Age music, this very steady rising and falling of computerized notes that had all the rhythm of the respirator beside my father's hospital bed just before he died. In Millbrae, I took the exit off the Camino Real and bypassed the mall's parking lot, all those cars baking in the sun, and I cruised through the housing developments with names like Hunter's Arch, Palomino Meadows, and Eureka Fields, as slowly as a cop or a child molester, hating California houses. So flat and one story, stucco and wood, so many pink or peach. Most of them had a short driveway leading to a carport, a basketball hoop nailed just under its green fiberglass roof. Inside on the smooth-looking concrete were beach balls and plastic bats and dog-chewed frisbees. As I continued driving slowly by, I tried to remember the ages of Lester's kids, but I couldn't. Some of the houses were shaded by eucalyptus trees, their thin gray bark peeling like a molting insect's. Other homes were completely exposed with small flower gardens on each side of their front doors. I passed one stucco house the color of a banana and saw a tanned blonde woman in shorts and a tank top lying out in the sun in a lawn chair. Her legs glistened with baby oil, and her nails were painted bright pink. There was a Toyota in the driveway, heat flashing through my stomach, but I could see it wasn't Lester's, and I kept driving, wondering more than ever now what his wife looked like, what they were saying to each other right now. Were they making love one last time, the way people sometimes did at the end? And was it the end? I wasn't so sure, and I was surprised at how resentful I felt. I wondered again if I should try and warn him he might be in trouble at work, but that's not why I'd be calling him, and I knew it. I lit a cigarette and continued driving slowly down one quiet, winding street to the next, looking out at all this family life from behind Nicky Lazzaro's aviator sunglasses, my stomach as tight and hot as stretched rubber about to break. I guess I'd planned to get through the rest of the afternoon with a double feature at the Cineplex, but once I got inside the terracotta-tiled mall, standing in line with other people who could afford to see a movie in the middle of a weekday, kids out of school for the summer, retired old ladies straining to read the marquee, I stepped away, shaking my head like a crazy woman, the kind you see in the city talking to the air, feeding invisible birds. My stomach hurt. In front of the theater was a granite wishing fountain and a pool full of pocket change. On the other side was a Mexican restaurant from a chain you only see on the West Coast, and I went in and sat at a blue-tiled table at the window, heard myself order a guacamole salad and a drink, a strawberry margarita. I could have asked for a virgin, but I didn't. My order came right away, but the sight of the avocado cream spooned over lettuce made me feel queasy, and I pushed it away and drank from the margarita, which was cold and sweet. Over the restaurant's stereo speakers came a fast salsa beat behind six or seven guitars. I could already feel the tequila in the blood of my face. I ordered another, my sluggishness from last night's beer replaced by a liquid lightness, and I smoked a cigarette and sipped my cool strawberry heat. I watched people go by in the main corridor of the mall, but I wasn't really seeing them, just their movement, their endless stroll to buy things. A man caught my eye, thin and blonde, holding his little girl's hand while a baby slept in a sling across his chest. They walked right by the window, the girl trailing her fingers across the glass, her young father smiling at something she was saying. But they didn't look in, and I drew deep on my cigarette and put it out before all the smoke had even filled me with what I knew, that Lester would not leave his family. He would stay with his wife, stay in his own desperation to spare his kids any. This was suddenly so clear to me, I wondered if I'd really known it all along. Les wasn't the kind to turn his back on what was expected of him just because he was unhappy. Every 2 or 3 years, he might have a week-long fling with someone like me, a street woman he'd meet through his job, but that was as close as he'd get to chucking the whole thing. I knew this. He might not yet, but I did. He might come back tonight, but if he did, he'd be full of family pain and resolve. He'd take me out for a memorable dinner date, or maybe cook me something, then make love to me like a man taking in oxygen before he goes on a long underwater trip. He'd pack his car and in the morning be gone, only to find out at work that his time with me would cost him even more than he thought. My waitress came, asked if my salad was all right, and I said no, it wasn't. It's too green. She was young, short and chunky with shoulder-length blonde hair, and she looked like she was about to explain to me that guacamole has avocados in it, which are green. But I cut her off and asked for another drink, thinking, as she left with my salad, that she's green. She's new to the world, and it's going to eat her. It eats everyone. I thought I was going to cry. I refused to. With my third margarita, she brought the check. A sign, I knew, for me not to bother ordering another one. I didn't like getting the message like that. I sipped my drink, as iced and fruity as the first two, licking the rim, turning the glass till all the salt was gone, swallowing it, telling myself I wouldn't be at the fish camp when he did come. The music stopped. I could hear the tink of someone's silverware, the opening of the kitchen door. My face felt as soft as a clay doll's. I wanted one more drink, but I knew it was no use to try and get another, that mall restaurants have 3-drink ceilings for their customers because they think drunk people shoplift more, or don't shop enough, or scare away real customers. Knowing this didn't take away what I felt as I left my child waitress a good tip and stepped out into the main mall looking for another restaurant, feeling watched, monitored. The place was loud with voices, the ring of cash registers, different kinds of music coming from each shop, like it's all a test to see how much you can take. Teenage girls talking and giggling in twos and threes, their hair high, their nails flashing. I passed some in front of a CD shop, and one of them glanced at me, then turned back to the huddle of her friends. I stopped and stood still, my face warm. Other shoppers walked around me as I watched these girls, waited for any of them to look at me again, try and say something cute or even make a face. They were all copies of each other. They wore jeans 3 sizes too big, pastel Gap t-shirts tucked in loose or tight to either show off their breasts or hide them, tacky leather pocketbooks over one shoulder, loose bracelets jangling on their wrists, their makeup too heavy. They all chewed gum, talking at once, oblivious to the 36-year-old woman watching them, wanting, for a day anyway, no, for just this minute, to be them again, though I never had been in the first place. Not really. Not a girl with girlfriends. Now, 20 years later, I could be their mother, but I wasn't anyone's mother, or wife. I wasn't a real girlfriend to anybody, or a friend. I was barely a sister, and whenever I thought of myself as a daughter, my body felt too small and filthy to live in. At the far end of the mall, I wandered into an upscale pizzeria, sat in the back, and ordered a glass of white wine, because they sold only that and beer. The lunch rush was over, and just a few tables were taken up. The ceilings were low, and the walls were covered with fake antiques, mirrors set in leather ox yokes, green glass kerosene lamps, yellowed newsprint photos of strongmen, and wood carvings of Indians. It was quiet back here. Dim and cool, no music, just the sound of the busboy still clearing the table. I smoked my cigarette, drank from my wine, and pretended to study the menu. When the waiter came for my order, I smiled up at him, careful not to smile too hard, and tried to say very clearly, concentrating on not mumbling my words, "I don't see anything I want." I'll have another Chardonnay, please. He took my order and menu without a word. I must have just sat there a little while, because when he came back with my second glass of wine and a basket of sliced Italian bread, I went to put out my last cigarette and saw it was a long ash and a filter between my fingers. I took a tight, ladylike sip of my new wine. I started to butter the bread I knew I wouldn't eat. My head and face felt blended, one the other, the second evaporating into my skull and hair, and today might as well be yesterday when I was a girl, 9 or 10, and every Saturday my father would take me with him on his rounds to deliver linens to restaurants and butcher shops and nursing homes up and down old Route 1, me in the passenger seat of his brown van, him smoking a Garcia y Vega cigar, the radio tuned to a baseball game, or to a station playing music from when he was younger. But to me he had always been old, a small, quiet man with thick glasses and thin lips, his hands always busy, and mine too, the two of us pressing clean linens on the electric roller we had in the basement, me on a stool at the feed end of the rollers, Dad sitting at the catch end because he could fold faster and better than me, and he'd taught me how to use the knee lever that would open the hot rollers so I could slide in the first tablecloth or apron or napkin. But after doing that, he didn't want me to use the lever again, didn't want to have to slow down to set in each piece of linen, taught me instead to take the corners of the next piece and with my thumbs and forefingers hold it to the corners of the last piece being pulled slowly through so one rolled straight into the other and we worked, like Henry Ford. And I kept burning my fingertips as I fed one piece of linen in after the next. But he seemed so content sitting on the other end of the roller from me. Quiet, but maybe proud he had such a useful daughter. That I never told him about my fingers because they seemed beside the point to me. And they always felt better when he'd buy me a cold Coke at one of the restaurants after, and I'd put my fingers into the ice. My wine was almost gone. My head and body were pulsing. And I lit a cigarette, held the lighted match close to my face, studied its flame, the blue and green sulfur colors at the base as it spread down the cardboard shaft. I watched it reach my fingertips, bumping up against flesh that wouldn't burn, and I didn't feel much and dropped it smoking onto the table. Saw myself dropping one in the dry shrubs around my father's house, the flames rising up to the windows, ashes to ashes. Dust to dust. I saw my house burning to the ground, the flames eating everything inside, the Persian carpets and fancy furniture, the pictures of the bearded horsemen on the wall, the colonel and the Shah, even their family portrait, the fire so hot the glass would blacken and shatter and the beautiful daughter would curl up into a fine ash. But then I thought of Mrs. Baruni, the weeping little Arab woman and her love of the Italian people, her ability to be at the same party as Sophia Loren. I didn't want to hurt her, just everything she owned. I would have to find a way to get her out of the house before I burned it. The son, too. A diversion, maybe. A fire in the front yard. The bands in my stomach vibrated with this thought, and I felt tickled by it, ready to laugh. Soon, I was walking through all that bright noise into Sears, down the clean, wide aisles, past brand-new power tools and fishing gear, lawnmowers and lounge chairs, air filters, and finally, gasoline cans. I seemed to watch them from a distance, like I'd just been dropped off somewhere to run an errand for someone, and I forgot what it was. There was a stack of them, 5-gallon and made of tin, painted bright red with yellow stripes. They were beautiful in a way. And I thought how nice it must be for other people's husbands to buy these, to fill them with gas for the lawnmowers on a Saturday morning. I thought of Lester's house at Eureka Fields, the one I never found. Did he cut it himself? Was that part of his family life? Next to the gas cans were shelves of charcoal lighter and bags of charcoal. Should I buy some for the hibachi in the trunk? But after tonight, if even then, I knew the fish camp would be a memory. And so then what would I do? Spend months parking my car in rest areas, barbecuing my supper, looking for a safe place to sleep till Connie had settled the lawsuit with the county? Months? I picked up a gas can. It was light in my hand, only a reminder of what heavy could be. The kid behind the counter asked if I needed a funnel. Nope, I said, no longer caring if I sounded loaded or not. Just a book of matches. And he smiled, this skinny-necked 19-year-old, like he knew firsthand the sort of problems solutions like this required. And out in the parking lot, I carried my new gas can and saw the weather had changed to one of those West Coast fogs moving in from the beach, the sky gray, the air cooler, smelling like wet metal, though the cars were dry and the trunk lid of my Bonneville was still hot from sitting in the sun. I felt it against my palm as I steadied myself to unlock it, my gas can at my feet like a loyal dog, my face feeling strange, stuck in a smile that came from deep inside me. I was having a hard time sliding the key in. Cars were coming and going throughout the parking lot. I could hear the squeak of shopping cart wheels over asphalt. Somebody's child crying far away. The trunk lock clicked. I stooped for the can. And there in my trunk, next to Nick's hibachi, was Lester's coiled black leather belt, the fine checks in the grip of his gun, the worn black of its holster, and it was like being 11 again, walking into my brother's room for a pencil or pen, pulling open drawers and finding a color magazine of women sucking off men, when all the tiny currents open in you, and they feel like evil and opportunity all at once, temptation and salvation, the cause and the cure. Touch it. Pick it up. Take it away with you. And so I did. In one fluid motion, I put the gas can in and pulled the coiled leather snake out, kept it tucked under my arm as I unlocked my door, rested it on the seat beside me, what Lester left behind before we went into the truck stop bar for our last dance, his sheriffness, his sword, like a gift he'd willed me, a piece of him to carry and remember him by. I thought of us making love on the banks of the Purisima, him pulling out of me and coming all over my stomach, hedging his bets. I thought how a man's dried cum smells like dead shrimp, how I'd never even shot a gun before, just held one, a small one my first husband owned for about a month when the white snake wriggled through us, and in the fluorescent light of the bathroom he had me hold it loaded, pointed at my reflection in the mirror. I drove north on the Camino Real, the King's Highway. I reached over and rested my hand on the gun, felt its steel indifference. I kept my fingers on it as I drove the 2 miles to San Bruno, passing ugly housing developments on each side of the freeway, their hot-top lanes broken up by an occasional grove of eucalyptus trees that looked olive in the gray light of the beach fog. I pushed in the Tom Petty cassette and turned him up almost all the way, turned into a mini-mall, placing the gun and holster on the floor, locking the Bonneville and walking into a package store next to a hair salon. I bought 3 Bacardi nips and 2 Diet Cokes, a pack of spearmint gum. Back in the car, I didn't remember who had sold me these things. A man? A woman? I parked in the far corner of the lot near a row of manzanita brush, dumped half of one soda out the window, poured in 2 of the nips, sipped pure Caribbean heat, smoking, listening to Tom Petty on the cassette player, but keeping it low, not wanting to draw any attention to myself, feeling like a cop in a parked cruiser, looking out the window at cars, people going in and out of stores. I was waiting for something to happen. Through the brush to my right was a self-serve gas station. I started the car, took a huge drink of my diet rum, but the bubbles were too much and I coughed and started to gag and had to lean out the window, but nothing came. I smoked 2 cigarettes before I noticed the music had stopped. I flipped over the tape, turned up the volume, and drove around to one of the pump islands of the gas station. I freed my gas can from the trunk and pressed the pump button, promising I would pay inside, and I started to fill the can, my cassette player loud through my open windows, louder than I had thought it was. Lester's gun was still on the floor where anyone could see it, but there was no one around, just a woman in the pay booth reading something, her glasses pinching the end of her nose, her chin fat, Tom Petty singing, "Break down, it's all right," his voice as high and over the edge as everything I felt, What the rational would call an enemy voice, I knew, but to me the sound of him was good company, a warm drunk hand on my back, encouragement for what I had to do, the inevitability of it, even. But the woman kept looking up from whatever she was reading, watching me with her head tilted back slightly so she could see me better through her glasses, so she could purse her lips at me like my own mother, already concluding just who I was and what I was up to before I even did. The pump clicked off, gasoline foaming up out of the can at my feet, the fume so strong it was all I could smell or taste. I leaned into the car, Petty singing a smear of sound, and I pulled a few bills from my pocketbook, but I didn't know if it was enough, and I didn't stop to count. The music so loud the cigarette butts vibrated in the ashtray, and all I could smell was gas, and I didn't want to leave Lester's gun exposed in the car, so I unsnapped it from its holster and slid it out, black with a square barrel, lighter than I thought it would be. I stuffed it into my pocketbook I hardly ever carried, hooked the strap over my shoulder and walked under the bay to the lady in the glass booth. I could see my reflection in the window glass, my lips parted like I was sleeping, my face as still as a nun's before she prays. The lady's glasses were halfway down her nose, pinching the flesh, and she had her fingers on the short microphone in front of her saying something, but it was just nagging static to me, nothing I could hear over my cassette player blasting from the Bonneville, Petty pleading, "Break down, it's all right, it's all right." The pay drawer sliding out and me dropping in my money, my left hand still in my pocketbook, resting on the hard, checkered grip of Lester's gun. The woman unfolded and counted the bills, $3. She shook her head, the drawer pushed out empty, and she sat there looking at me, waiting, her head tilted slightly, her face in a squint, her eyes narrowed like she couldn't bear me or the noise coming from my car another second. She shook her head again, quickly. She put her lips to the microphone, but then I stepped back, felt myself pulling out the gun, saw myself pointing it at her through the glass, her hands jerking up in front of her as she sucked her lips in as if she were holding her breath, her pinched nostrils trying to flare, her eyes filling up behind the glasses. I watched her, surprised, I suppose, at how suddenly things had changed between the two of us. I wanted to tell her, "It's all right, it's all right." Her lips were trembling, and her fingers were straightening into a church steeple. I lowered my arm, but her eyes weren't on me, they were on the gun, so I stuffed it into my pocketbook and walked back to my car, a pickup truck pulling into the opposite bay as I got in behind the wheel, turned the music down, and drove slowly back onto the street, my entire body as thin and light as the fog moving in around us, my trunk lid open, my full gas can still at the pumps.
I kneel upon newspapers applying glue to the broken legs of Nadere's mother's table. It has been a very tiring afternoon. I have yet to nap or take tea, and there persists an ache in my head between my eyes and ears, a sharp pulling in my neck. After the gente, Kathy Nicolo, drove away weeping, and my wife and I were back inside the bungalow, Nadi pushed into my hand a note written by this woman who was content to rob us of our future. Nadere stood upon the carpet, her eyes shining with anger and distrust of me, and I saw there was no keeping the truth of all this from her any longer. "Yes," I said in Farsi, placing the woman's note upon the counter. "These are our circumstances. What of it?" Nadere was quiet a moment, her eyes upon me but her face unchanged, her head leaning downwards to the side, as if attempting to hear again what I had said. Then in Farsi she cursed me, calling me a thief, a dog, and a man with no father. She became ugly, zeshed, her eyes turning small, the flesh between them deeply creased. But my own fury had been spent forcing this Nicolo woman from our home, and I felt quite fatigued, empty of any emotion of any sort. Enough of these emotions. I moved aside the broken table and sat upon the sofa, my hands heavy and loose in my lap, and I felt quite far away as I waited for Nadere to finish insulting me in my judgment, my capabilities, my lack of forthrightness with her. All of these things I let pass over me like training jets with no ammunition, for I could see she was close to the tears of fear that have ruled her since the fall of our society. And yes, soon enough she was weeping, exposing to me her ignorant belief we would now be deported from this country for stealing the young woman's home. "Did she say this, Nadi?" I asked of my wife as calmly as one would a child who has just fallen and struck her chin on a stone. But she did not answer me. She continued to curse me for ever being a Junob Sarhang, a high officer in a position of prominence that has secured all of our names upon the death list so we can never return home. From her I have heard all these things before, ever since our escape to Bahrain in Europe, and now California, and I of course should have known, on this day when my wife telephoned her sister in Tehran, that she might show me continued disrespect all over again. But for perhaps the very first time, as I sat as heavy as sand upon the sofa while she continued to be as hysterical as a drunk gypsy, I wanted no more to do with this woman. I could not bear another moment, and I allowed myself to contemplate living the remainder of my days and nights without her. I would rent a small room on a quiet street in a quiet city, and I would live as a holy man, owning only a single mattress, a simple samovar, and a few necessary items of clothing. I would rise before the sun and pray to the east. I would fast not only for the month of Ramadan, but every week as well. I would free myself of all constraints. I would become as light as dust. But I could not listen to Nadire very much longer. She began to call me tagoti, selfish, and this I could not bear to hear. I stood and inquired who she thought I was working so hard for. Me? I do nothing for myself. Hichi, nothing. For a very long while we argued like city cab drivers, neither giving way to the other, my wife insisting the young woman was very nice. Very nice? She has sent an armed man to threaten us, Nadire. Sangnandas, do not throw these silly stones. Again and again, I attempted to explain for her I knew nothing of all this at the time of the sale, and now it is the problem of someone else, not our own. God has given to us this bungalow, Nadi. We will have no other opportunity to make such money. I attempted to explain the young woman Nicolo had an even greater opportunity to enrich herself because an entire county had acted against her. But to this Nadi would not listen. She has always been a superstitious woman, especially when dealing with people less fortunate than ourselves. In Tehran, at the bazaars and shops, she would bring extra money, handfuls of tomans, to give to any beggar that asked, the crippled and blind, those with burned faces and missing arms or hands, the victims of savak. And if there was no beggar in the crowd, she would not leave for shopping until she had found one to give our money. And it is evident to me now this Kathy Nicolo has become a beggar for Nadi, one we must somehow appease or be cursed. And then my wife cursed me, barricading herself once more in her room.
I drove west for Corona. At the wide, dry turnoff for a housing complex, I stopped, slammed my trunk shut, and started driving again, thinking I only had so much time before the police came looking for my Bonneville, for the armed woman in it. My feet and legs and chest were a flock of drunk birds, and I sipped my diet rum and smoked and drove, obeying all the traffic lights on Hillside Boulevard, my window down, smelling the Pacific Ocean now, the air cool and wet, the sky gray. Tom Petty turned so low he was more like a small voice in my head, which felt wide open in the back. Birds flying in and out of me. In downtown Corona, the fog was so thick I couldn't see the water or even the sand at the beach. The one-story shops and stores stood out in the gray, and as I passed the drugstore, I saw a Corona police cruiser parked around the corner, a young cop sitting inside reading something, and I felt so thin and light I thought the birds would carry me away. Lester's gun on the seat beside me. I looked straight ahead and drove past the policeman, keeping my head still, checking the rearview mirror, but there was no one behind me, and I drove through the blinking yellow light up the hill of Bisgrove Street. I wasn't sure what I was doing, or what I would do next, or even how the last few minutes of this day had come to happen, but as I crested the hill, I could see the colonel's white Buick in my driveway, my lawn trimmed neatly, The widow's walk drawing attention to itself with the new garden furniture on it, the large white umbrella opened to the gray sky. Where else could I go but home? I pulled the car into the driveway behind the colonel's, turned off the engine and radio, and just sat behind the wheel. My chin kept dropping to my chest, my hair and my face, my veins an alcoholic vapor ready to burn. Nothing but tequila, wine, and rum feeding me into a lava river, a huge molten mother rolling over me, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and the small white house in front of me didn't even look like my home. It looked so white and square and orderly, the shrubs under the windows thick and green and well-trimmed. I thought again of Lester, his crooked mustache and sad brown eyes. I wanted to kiss him again and hold him. But it felt like needing to see my father again, too, and Dad was dead, and his little retirement house was gone, and a whimper seemed to come up and out of my mouth, and I felt sorry I'd scared that woman as much as I did. I felt the black gun on the seat beside me, a sleeping snake that woke up, now a silent prankster egging me on, and I reached over and lifted it, sniffing its small black hole, but all I could smell was the gas on my fingers. Then it was back in my lap. I could see it through the hair in front of my face. I waited, but no one came out of the house. I waited some more, and I suppose I closed my eyes once, but that was a mistake. A night ship rolling in the surf. When I opened them again, there was the sound of birds from the woods across the street. A gentle conversation. Then, as if this was an idea I just wanted to try out to see how it fit, I pressed the end of the barrel to my breastbone, my eyes closed. The ship beginning to break up, my thumb against the trigger, everything coming to a fine dark point in my head.
I have wrapped one table leg in tape and begin wrapping the other, its glue falling in droplets to the newspaper. My fingers are sticking, and the pain in my neck now rises up through the back of my head. I know I must lie down and rest, but I must first finish securing the table leg, or it will set wrongly. From Nadi's locked room comes once again the music of Gugush, this too sweet sugar, the music of romantics ignorant of any history but their own. But at this moment, I find it more comforting than silence. Better than the marching of my thoughts that do not end, those tired directives from myself to continue with the strategy I know is best for my family. I think of my Soraya, so ziba, of such beauty, her name is no longer Behrani, but Farasat. I feel a pinch in my heart at the memory of her shame of us, of me, of the dinner we held for her, and her quiet husband and his family. My head aches. It feels squeezed as if between two stones. My knees and back are stiff and tired. I feel so very poor, so old. But I will not be misunderstood by my own blood. I must telephone Soraya and arrange a time for us to meet, to eat lunch or dinner together, father and daughter only. Perhaps we will stroll along Fisherman's Wharf with the touring people in the city, her slender arm hooked inside my own, as I tell to her, what? What do I say to my daughter? Please do not look down upon me because I no longer have a powerful position in our society. I am not to blame our society no longer exists. It is not my fault we are in America now, where only money is respected. Please, daughter, make an attempt to forget how we once lived. Put it behind you, and do not shame us by talking of it as if we are nothing at all now without recalling what we once were. We are your mother and father. Do not forget this. I wash my hands at Nadi's kitchen sink, splash cold water upon my face, and I know I am a liar, for these words in my head are as hollow as a crippled man's wooden leg. I do not believe them myself. This small bungalow is not even the size of our outbuilding in which Bachmann packed our automobile in the capital city. Perhaps Soraya was right to belittle it with her nervous recounting of who we really were, who her father was. But I must rest now. I am not yet beaten. Perhaps I must lower my price to secure a buyer more quickly. If I only double my investment with a sale, that will still be $100,000 in our pockets. Surely, in this country, that kind of seed can yield a tree. Outdoors, the day is gray, and there is fog hanging in the dark trees of the woodland across the street. The front lock remains engaged, and I am not certain Ismail has carried his key with him. He never carries anything in his pockets, but I cannot leave the door free for him. I will simply have to awaken to his knocking. I leave the long wrecking iron in the corner beside the door, and I am turning from my office when I see what my eyes do not believe they are seeing. Behind my Buick Regal is the red automobile of the beggar Kathy Nicolo. I did not hear her arrive. She must have done so while I was washing at the kitchen sink. She sits inside her car, her eyes closed, her head resting on the neck support of her seat, her chin tilted upward, her throat long and white. Her black hair is tangled, and some of it rests upon her cheek. And I am feeling strangely because I did not hear her arrive, and because at this moment she looks so very much like my long-dead cousin Jasmine, that for a moment I do not know where I am, or what is the day, or how it is I came to be here. Is she sleeping? Is she this illogical? But I feel little as I step outside into the cool gray air, only fatigue and confusion and a deep feeling in my heart that perhaps what I see before me is a dream. The woman Kathy Nicolo has not moved. Her head still rests upon the seat and her eyes are shut. But as I draw closer, she begins to weep silently, turning her face from side to side, her mouth open in words that do not come. Then she grimaces, her eyes squeezing closed, and her shoulders curving forward. Her body becomes loose, her shoulders fall back, and she continues to cry, shaking her head and moving her mouth as if she were attempting to persuade someone yet unseen to do something quite urgent. She appears younger to me as she weeps, with not many more years than my Soraya, and I feel a tenderness as I move closer, a momentary regret at having treated her before so roughly, for having pushed her into her auto as if she were a man. However, I must tell her firmly that she must leave. Once more she makes a face, and the feeling I am in a dream increases, for I see both of her hands upon a large automatic pistol, its barrel pushed to her heart, one of her thumbs pressing against its trigger, which is evidently locked by its safety mechanism. Then I feel a witness to my own hand as it reaches inside the open window and twists the weapon from her grasp. She opens her eyes. They are reddened, and she blinks them as if coming out of a deep sleep, but then she regards me and the pistol, and she cries openly, her hair falling across her eyes and mouth. I press the release button, remove the fully loaded magazine from its grip, then pull back the sliding mechanism for any bullet in the chamber. There is none. My hands tremble as I deposit the ammunition clip into my pants pocket, as I push the pistol into the waistband of my trousers, and open the door to help this Kathy Nicolo from her automobile. The interior smells of benzene, and she of liquor and cigarette smoke. She pushes my hands away and cries more loudly, but there is little strength in her, and I lead her from the car, guiding her to the door, for she is drunk, masked, and once inside, standing unsteadily in the living room area, my arm upon her elbow, she begins to speak through her crying, her hair hanging before her face. She speaks of not caring about this house any longer, simply not caring about anything. She talks loudly, the fashion in which the very drunk do, and I wish for Nadire to come from the music behind her closed door and witness this. See this very nice, intoxicated girl who is attempting to shoot herself in front of our home. My legs have become soft and I need Nadi's help, but I am fearful to leave this Kathy Nicolo even for a moment by herself. She cries more quietly now, swaying upon her feet like a marionette. I lead her slowly into my son's room, sit her upon his bed, and lay her down, stooping to lift her bare legs upon the mattress as well. To me she turns her face, wet with her crying, and she says, I just... Can't we just... She weeps, but soon her chin lowers and she appears to relax deeper into my son's pillow. Nikki? Nahe, I answer in Farsi. Then, in English, you must sleep now. You must rest. I place Ismail's chair in front of the bed and sit. The pistol is uncomfortably tight against me, and I pull it free, hold it in my hands. I smell the lubricant on its surface, and I think of Tehran. Where does a young woman acquire a weapon such as this? She appears to be sleeping, and I consider for a moment removing her Reebok shoes, but I do not. I watch the young woman sleep, watch her mouth open slightly as she does. Beneath her brightly colored Fisherman's Wharf t-shirt, her breasts barely rise and fall, and I regard the pistol in my hands, see Jasmine falling to the ground, her long hair untamed, her hand pressed between her breasts, her white gown growing as red as saffron. The woman Kathy Nicola remains sleeping throughout the afternoon and into the early evening. I at first considered to tell Nadi directly, but my wife's door was still shut to me, Gugush singing her away from her headaches and into a melancholy sleep. And no immediate good would come from her knowing our present situation. The panic of the weak never helps the strong. I poured for myself tea from the samovar in the kitchen and sat at the counter bar with the unloaded pistol, and I once again began to weigh the alternative courses of action before me. I could of course telephone to the police and pursue criminal charges against Kathy Nicola, charges for trespassing on my family's property with a dangerous weapon. But upon opening the telephone book to the page listing the number of the Corona police, I found I was unable to make the necessary call, for it was clear to me this woman was only intent on harming herself, and in my mind I saw repeatedly her crying face as she attempted, with great ignorance of sidearms, to fire a large bullet into her breast. I put another cube of sugar into my mouth, took a drink from my hot Persian tea, and listened for a time to the muffled cassette music coming from Nadi's room. Yes, it was weakly romantic, but it put me in mind of my boyhood home in Rasht, of wrestling under the sun in the dusty road with my fat cousin Kamfar, his sister Jasmine watching us from behind the wall of stones before my father's house, only the top half of her small face exposed, her large eyes smiling. I thought of Purat's nephew Bijan, who would speak with impunity of severing the limbs of children while I drank vodka beside him, convincing myself that my refusal to dip into the Masfah Khiara with him was a sufficient moral stand for a man of my station to make. But on those evenings, I would drink enough for three men, and for days afterwards would carry out my daily duties in a joyless manner, treating junior officers in a lowly fashion and giving orders whose sole design was to show my inferiors who was truly in charge. Three times I walked silently down the corridor to make an inspection of this Kathy Nicola. Each time I saw she had not moved her position, but continued sleeping as still as a small child, her face turned in my direction, her eyes closed, a portion of her hair lying across her lips, which were partly opened. My son's room smelled of her now, of old liquor from the mouth, and for an instant I felt disgust rise in me. But then, perhaps like a bubble of air from deep water that dissipates once it reaches the surface, I felt no more disgust, only pity for this Kathy Nicola, pity and a newfound pull in my heart to treat her well. In my country there is an old belief that if a bird flies into your home, it is an angel who has come to guide you, and you must look at its presence as a blessing from God. Once, when Saraya was still a young girl, and we were spending the summer at our bungalow on the Caspian Sea, she discovered at the base of a cypress tree a small young bird whose wings had been broken, and she brought it to us. Nadire made for its wing a wooden splint, and they together nursed the bird with sugar water and bits of bread, and by summer's end they took it from its cage to our porch overlooking the sea. Saraya parted her fingers, and the bird flew up and away into the woodlands. For 2 days our daughter cried, though at the end she told to us she was very happy a broken angel had come to bless our home. I return to the kitchen and drink more tea. The bungalow has grown quiet. No more gougouche, only the silence of two sleeping women. The gray fog outdoors has not lifted, and I turn on the kitchen's overhead light. It shines upon the silver samovar on the opposite counter, upon the clean and dry plates in Nadi's dish rack. I feel strangely content, and I am put in mind of that afternoon with the Iraqi in his shop near the highway department depot when we played backgammon near the window, our silence a mutual acceptance to let the blood between our two countries flow under the bridge away from us. For days afterwards, working as a garbage soldier on the highway with the old Vietnamese Tran and the Panamanians, I felt a lightness and goodness in me, and even Mendez, with the long scar upon his arm and the smell of old wine in his sweat, even he could not pull hatred from me as he called me old man in his mother tongue, as he dropped his empty water cup upon the ground for Tran to retrieve. And this feeling is within me once more. Who can say how many more desperate and drunken moments would have passed before this Kathy Nicolo found the safety mechanism and then succeeded in shooting her heart very still? Yes, pride is weak vanity, but I do feel a sense of joy at having saved life. And yes, the woman is intoxicated, but nonetheless I am encouraged by her words of not caring any longer for this house. Perhaps after waking from her sleep, after eating a fine meal prepared by Nadi, Kathy Nicolo will be willing to put that in writing, will be sufficiently able to acknowledge who her real enemy has become, and she will begin acting accordingly. But now I must rouse Nadere to prepare an evening meal. I must enter her darkened room with its scent of facial cream and cotton bedding, and I must sit and tell to her of the sad drunken bird I found outside our door, of the beggar angel asleep in our son's room. Part 2. It was dark now, and Lester had been sitting on the fish camp's porch for over 2 hours. The fog was thick in the trees, and it made the black woods around the cabin appear to be under a milky water. He could still smell the maple he'd cut, split, and stacked, and twice he heard a car go by on the asphalt along the Purisima, and he waited for the engine to gear down, for the swing of the headlights through the trees, but they didn't come, and so he waited. He was hungry, thirsty too, but he stayed in the cane chair near the screen door and didn't move. He kept seeing Bethany's face, the way she looked this afternoon, standing at the kitchen table in her school dress. She had just come home, and already she was waiting to hear from him what was happening to them, to their family, standing there bravely waiting for the words to come out of his mouth. But then the phone rang and Carol answered it, her nose stopped up. In a tired tone, she said it was for him, and she left the receiver on the counter and went to Bethany, turned, and walked her gently from the room. Lester watched them go through the foyer and up the stairs before he moved to the phone. It was Lieutenant Alvarez, Internal Affairs. Lester knew him, but not well, because he was IA and because he was a short and humorless ex-Marine who ran 6 miles every morning before work, whose on-duty appearance and professional record were as spotless as the tie he wore even during the summer months when the sheriff didn't require it. Other deputies felt automatically uncomfortable around him. But this is not what Lester felt as he picked up the phone, his daughter upstairs about to break. He felt interrupted to an almost cruel degree, and he answered as if he didn't know who was on the other end. What? The lieutenant identified himself in that calculated, emotionless tone of his, pausing to give Lester a chance to get his protocol in order, but Lester stayed quiet, and Alvarez had just a trace of heat in his voice as he asked Lester to dispatch himself immediately to Redwood City for a talk. Lester let out a long breath and could feel his heart beating in it. Can it wait till I'm back on duty, sir? No, deputy, it cannot. The lieutenant said he would be in his office and hung up directly, but Lester had no plans to drive directly to the Hall of Justice to be interrogated by that prick about what could only be his after-hours visit to the Iranian colonel. And as he hung up, he considered denying everything, just lying about it all. He wasn't up to facing any more truths right now, not after a day that began early this morning with him walking into the house hungover, his hair still wet from the Purisima riverbed, Kathy's smell still on his skin. Carol had been in the kitchen pouring water into the coffee maker at the counter, and she had kept her back to him, said in a wary voice she wasn't expecting him. Lester apologized for not calling first, and he sat at his chair at the table and watched his wife wash the kids' breakfast dishes. Her frosted hair was tied and pinned in a knot at the back of her head, and she wore khaki shorts and a white sleeveless top. Her upper arms looked fleshy, always had, though that had never bothered Lester, and whenever she'd complain about them, he'd tell her she was fine just the way she was. Any minute, she was. When the coffee was done, she poured herself some and sat down, leaving Lester to get up and pour his own. He stirred milk into his cup and asked if Nate was upstairs, and she said no, she just dropped him off at her sister's in Hillsboro. I have to go into the city today. Lester knew what that meant. He sat back down, and in the next few hours watched his wife become four completely different people. For the first hour or so, she was detached, speaking as coolly and rationally as the lawyer she was going to Frisco to see. She sat erect in her chair, and she spoke of their 9-year marriage as a contract they were both bound to because they had children now, and it had to be honored. What is a vow, after all, Lester? What is a vow? He told her he couldn't answer that. He didn't know what a vow was anymore. But by late morning, all her rigid composure fell away, and she began screaming that he was a weak, self-serving son of a bitch, and so's the fucking whore you're sleeping with. And she threw her coffee mug at him, but it missed and hit the wall and didn't break. He picked it up, but didn't know quite where to begin, so he said very little as she paced back and forth, yelled until she finally crumpled, crying into her hands, and that one Lester could no longer harden himself to, and he went to her and held her and even cried with her. But he was feeling more relieved than anything else. The truth was out. Just hold on. Just ride out the storm. Then, inexplicably, the day was half gone. Where had it gone? It was already early afternoon, time for Bethany to come home from school, and when she came walking tentatively into the house, walking almost on her toes, Lester watched Carol become the mother she was. Wiping the tears from her face, she put on a smile and squatted with her arms outstretched to hold her daughter. Lester felt a distant but great admiration for her then, the same kind he had had for her ever since he first saw her in an ethics course in college, when she stood and openly called the professor a fool for insinuating a secular society was inherently more tolerant and therefore more democratic than a religious one, her eyes bright with conviction, her back straight, all 10 fingertips resting on her desk so they wouldn't shake. And after getting off the phone with Alvarez, Lester knew he had to at least fake that sort of courage, put on a father's capable face, and with conviction walk upstairs to his daughter's room and say the right words, though it wouldn't be the whole truth, not just now anyway, not today. His wife and daughter were upstairs in Bethany's room. She was on her bed, on her back, looking up at the ceiling, her face even more pale now. She was holding her stuffed Peter Rabbit to her stomach with both hands, and Carol was sitting on the bed beside her, smoothing her hair away from her face. He stepped inside the room, but when the floorboards creaked beneath the rug, only Carol glanced up at him, her eyes narrowed, her lips a flat line. In the quiet, his daughter turned her face to him, her eyes as open and unblinking as when she was an infant, staring up at him from her crib, completely dependent, yet completely trusting of his every move. And she trusted him now. He could see it in her face. Though she was being so still and quiet, it was as if she thought if she didn't say a word or move too suddenly, everything would be all right again. Everything would go back to the way it was. And Lester stood still too, conscious only of his heart beating, of the air entering and leaving his lungs, and his daughter's gaze kept him right there, though he wasn't quite sure just where that was anymore. Carol's voice was calm. Say something, Lester. Then his voice came out of him, but it wasn't his really. An approximation of his sound, of where he'd come from, and where he was, and where he wanted desperately to be next, though it wasn't down at the department where his voice told his wife and daughter he had to go for a meeting. It was at the fish camp with Kathy Nicolo, with that deep-eyed, sweet-tasting, tough and funny woman who was now lodged so deeply inside him it had become almost physically painful to continue enduring with Carol what he didn't share with her anymore, to sleep in the same bed with her, to eat at the same table, sit on the same couch and toilet. I've been called in to work, Bethany, hon. I can't talk now, but everything's okay, sweetie. You'll see. Everything's fine. Bethany looked from him to her mother as if she were searching for some verification of what her father had just said. Carol smiled at her, bravely, Lester thought. Then she shot him an icy glance and left the room. Lester kissed his daughter on her forehead, and he could smell the clean skin of her scalp. She looked like she wanted to say something, to maybe ask him something, but he had no words for her right now. Not yet. I've got to go to work now. Don't worry about anything, honey pie. Everything's fine. And he said it in such a sure and solid voice, he felt close to believing it himself. Downstairs, Carol sat at the kitchen table, her arms resting in front of her. She was looking straight at the cabinets, and he wanted to say something comforting to her, too, something that might fortify her for what lay ahead. But when he walked into the room, she didn't look at him, just said, "Go, Les. Please, just go." Lester knew he should have gotten into his Toyota and driven the 12 dutiful miles south to Redwood City in his appointment with Lieutenant Alvarez, but instead he drove west on 92 along the dry bed of the Pilarcitos River, past fogged-in fields of artichoke plant and occasional patches of manzanita he could barely see, for things were exceedingly clear to him, the kind of pristine clarity you can only get in the center of something big and reckless and on a path of its own. His heart beat at a high humming echo through his head and veins, and he kept seeing Kathy Nicolo, her lean, no-nonsense body, the way she'd cock her head slightly whenever she looked at him, like she wanted to believe what he said but didn't, not completely, her eyes always giving her away anyway, those small brown eyes that almost glittered with this dark, hopeful light. He had never seen eyes like that in a grown person before. They made her otherwise hard features soft. The dips in her cheeks, the lines around her mouth that seemed ingrained more from a grimace than a laugh, and he wanted to be inside her, to let go in the darkest center of her. At Half Moon Bay, he had to use his headlights in the fog, and he cut south on the coast highway for the Parisima River, and he couldn't get there fast enough. He was driving well over the speed limit, though he could only see 3 or 4 car lengths ahead, and twice he came fast on another car's taillights and he had to swerve, but still he only slowed once he got to the fish camp's dirt turnoff road, expecting to see Kathy's red Bonneville parked beneath the pine branches, but it wasn't, and so he hurried down the trail and into the cabin. Her suitcase was still up in the loft, propped open against the windows, and he climbed back down the ladder, breathing hard, cursing himself for being so needy, for having so little faith. For the first half hour, sitting on the porch, he let himself imagine where she might be and what she might be doing. Maybe she'd gone to the storage shed in San Bruno to get more of her belongings, or she could be at a grocery store buying some fresh ice for the cooler, some charcoal for the hibachi in her trunk. That's where he'd left his gun belt, too, and he shook his head at his increasing lack of judgment. She was breaking the law with that in her car, and he planned to take it from her trunk as soon as she pulled up. In the last light, he sat there waiting, watching the fog grow thicker in the trees along the trail, and he tried not to, but he kept seeing Bethany's face, the way she stared up at him from the bed, like she couldn't and wouldn't move until she heard from him what was happening and when, and most of all, why. And he understood her stillness because he felt it too. All around him, all the daily and definite parameters of his life, Carol, the department, and even Bethany and Nate, they seemed suspended just out of his field of vision, his range of hearing, even his truest feeling. He thought of Carol's having missed her appointment in Frisco today, picking their son up at his aunt's in Hillsboro. He imagined how she would buckle their 4-year-old into a seat while he asked if Daddy was home. Lester made himself picture this, but he allowed no more feeling to go with it than necessary. He knew Carol would say something comforting, like, "Daddy's at work, you'll see him tomorrow." And he felt sure what he told Bethany would hold her over till then, too, that everything would be all right. She'd see. Later, he would add that divorced kids do fine. Half of all your friends go visit their moms and dads and their new boyfriends and girlfriends, and everybody gets along. They even have fun. Maybe that's what he would try telling her tomorrow. Nate, too. But in a different way. A less complicated way. But he was getting way ahead of himself. And Kathy, too. If only she'd drive up and walk into the fogged-in darkness of the clearing. After the first hour of waiting, Lester began to worry that she might have been in a traffic accident, or was in a store when some kid walked in with a brand new $50 handgun he was aching to use, or else she had gone to a movie theater that began to smoke and burn. But these were deputy sheriff demons, and he knew it. The whore 24. When you never really punch out, 24 hours a day you look at your world like you're out on perpetual patrol, the gold still pinned to your shirt. Everybody even slightly out of line you give a double take. Every loudmouth in a restaurant, every jackrabbit at a traffic light, every corner full of kids bopping at nothing to do, they all get your attention. You never say anything to them because you're off duty and they're not usually breaking any rules anyway, but you're always poised for the outlaw. On a run of errands with your son in his car seat beside you, in your daydreams and nightdreams, too. And in Lester's dream, he was always alone, stuck in his patrol car in a vacant lot in broad daylight, every perp he'd ever arrested standing around his car waiting for him to come out. The child abusers and wife beaters, the rapists and stopping robbers and drunk drivers, the B&E artists and teenage hookers, the car thieves and arsonists, and the only murderer he ever took in for a booking, a clean-cut, soft-spoken man in a white starched shirt and black tie who had flagged him down on the main drag of East Palo Alto on a hot, bright Saturday afternoon, his fingers and forearms covered with the dried blood of his wife, mother, and sister-in-law. He had quietly asked Lester to take him into custody, but in Lester's dream, even he was out in the crowd, staring at him in his patrol car, waiting for him. Lester's doors would be locked, but the car engine would never turn over, and when he picked up the radio, he got nothing but silence. He'd reach for the pump shotgun in its rack beneath the dash, but it would always be stuck there, welded there, it seemed. He'd unholster his sidearm, take the safety off, pull back on the barrel to slide one into the firing chamber, but then children would appear in the crowd, the kids of all the perpetrators, even the abused kids. They'd stand beside their mothers and fathers, their faces blanched and soft-looking, expressionless, and he'd put his gun down on the seat and just wait for help to come. But it never did. Some nights the crowd would push in close to the car, pressing their faces to the glass, the children too, and Lester would try and point his gun only at the adults, but the adult faces would become children's, and the children would turn into their own hard-time parents, and Lester would just start shooting. The glass would pop and explode all around him. The faces would part and tear like thin cardboard, flapping open to the daylight behind them. He'd keep squeezing the trigger, feeling the kick in his hand, smelling the burnt powder in the air. Then the gun would jam, and everyone, even those he'd shot, would look at him with great disappointment, not at what he'd done, but at what he couldn't finish, like it was a true shame this was the only fight he had in him. Once in Daly City, Lester was working the 6-to-6 overnight and the bars had been closed a half hour when he got a call on a disturbance a block from the scene, an all-night self-serve gas station. He was in the lot of a coffee shop walking back to his car, and he dropped his full cup into a trash barrel and got into his cruiser, accelerating with only his flashers on, no sirens. Two men were in the shadows, just outside the light of the pumps. One of the men was small, and lay curled up on the ground, covering his ears and face with his arms, while the other swore in Spanish and kept kicking him in the head, neck, and back. He pushed the man over with his boot, then began kicking him in the chest and stomach. The big one looked up only briefly at the blue flash of Lester's patrol car, but he didn't stop, and Lester felt sure he was going to bolt any second. But even when Lester got out of the car and identified himself as a deputy sheriff, the big Latino kept kicking, and Lester felt fear move through him like a cold wind. He called in for an immediate backup and